fun, you know.
There's been, this concert was rehearsed and performed by the joint orchestras last week in New York at Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center. So it rehearsed for several days at Juilliard, and from the very start, there's been sort of the best kind of cheering for each other, the ultimate musician accolade of shuffling of feet or stamping of feet during rehearsals. Every time somebody had a really splendid solo, there'd be all of a sudden the shuffling of feet and within sections patting of each other's backs. So I think there is a kind of real cohesive go team, go approach. The supply of adrenaline is very healthy in a young orchestra.
I'd like you to characterize for me, Ara, the sound of a young orchestra. What is it that makes that sound?
I think there is still the thrill of discovery and the sheer tangible pleasure. And in this case, with an orchestra that's not accustomed to playing with each other, the sheer pleasure of playing with each other. There's just a kind of glee and delight in music making that's still completely fresh and it's in its original state. And you know, that's not to take away from the great orchestras in the world who bring years of experience and a different level of sophistication and insight. But there's something about the joy of music, I think, in a young musician's orchestra that's very tangible and audible.
That sort of indefatigable quality of a young orchestra. They don't know when they're done and when they're finished, you know, if you can always ask them to do more. And I think if you look at all the great conductors who work with young orchestras, and a large proportion fortunately do, I think they're better conductors as a result, because I think there's something in their game, whether they realize it or not, that they bring back into the professional scene that just reignites them. Even people like Bernard Haitink and Colin Davis and the sort of people that we're very fortunate to have.
Now turning to John Adams specifically. Now he gave the commencement address, I think, at the beginning of this last academic year, and he started out by thanking the students for having the courage to pursue a career in the arts. You've already performed this program with him in America. How has it been working with him particularly?
It's been especially nice because we're performing a piece of his own, and in rehearsal sometimes he'd say, I don't know why I did that, you know, I made it hard for you guys, you know, or he would talk about things and we know what he really wants. It's always so nice to have a living composer, and at the same time he's so down to earth and he's so friendly to us that it's not in any way an intimidating experience. It's just been very exciting, and he's been really good to us, and we've been learning so much, and we've been getting to know him, and he's a very, very important American composer, and for us to be able to work with him, we're very lucky and fortunate.
There was a wonderful moment in rehearsal. He stopped at a certain point and said, wherever it was, flutes from 38 to 48, just cut it, just cross it out. And there was a kind of dead silence in the room. It's this startling thing to be told. And he looked at them and he said, I can do that. I wrote it. And he said, it's always bothered me and now I take care of it.
Is there something good about working on a piece that's new to everyone in the orchestra? Is that helpful, or did you already know the piece?
I've never played, I've heard the piece before. I've never played it, and I think it was a very good thing for us, because as players, we were getting to know each other, the players from London, and if we were to play a piece that we know so well, we might have, and we probably would have had different ideas of how to play it, but we were in the same boat, learning a new piece. And so I thought it was very fitting that we were playing a new piece that most of us hadn't played.
I think also there's a sense that the integration of these styles and approaches we've been talking about may be a little easier this time, just on the fact that we're not dealing with 19th century music where the teachers of each of our institutions are saying, well, actually, you know, it goes like this. And the Brits are saying, well, actually, it goes like this. You know, with Feste Romane, it's only been ever, I think you were saying that it's only been done once at the Proms before. So most students, probably all of them, don't know that piece. Okay, the Ravel Piano Concerto is a different thing. And as you say, City Noir is not something that many people have played in the 2 years of its existence.
Mm. Now, I'm interested, when a student applies to Juilliard or to the Royal Academy, do they all have the ambition that they will one day end up as a soloist? How do you manage that?
No, I don't think they do, because I think for a start, students are very much better informed in terms of what they're letting themselves in for than ever before. I mean, I think they see the profession for what it is. It doesn't mean they don't have dreams, but I think they have a real sense that you've got to be flexible. You've got to. I think they can hear that musical life is much more eclectic. It's much more available, and if you do listen to what's on their iPods, it's completely different from what I was listening to for my iPod. No, there weren't iPods when I was young, but that range of music that I listened to was terribly narrow compared to what most students do. So there's a kind of sense that they can partake in a bigger menu of possibilities and opportunities. Having said that, I think they're aware that being a musician is a way of life. It's not just a profession, and that with that there are certain sacrifices, and one is that you don't get paid very well, usually, and the other is that sometimes there's huge fulfillment, and like any other job, there are other parts of the profession that can be a bit, not so exciting. But I the feeling is, and I think, Fabio, we were talking about this earlier, weren't we? There's a feeling that if you know in your heart that this is the only thing you want to do on this planet, then you will do it, even if someone tells you there are only 10 jobs in your city per year.
I think also the whole model of how one becomes a musician has changed, and for my taste, in rather healthy ways. There used to be what I call the monastic model of conservatories, in which you would lock yourself away in a hermetically sealed practice room for a dozen years, practice the Tchaikovsky concerto to perfection, only to emerge to a grateful public showering you with rose petals. And that model happily went out a long time ago, and I think schools have acknowledged that. And I think we're in a time of flux, but because we're in a time of flux, there are many more avenues and much more room for self-initiated avenues into musical life, just in the same way that musical tastes and expectations are broader, as Jonathan mentioned.
Fabiola, is that true for you?
It is definitely true. Even when I was very young, I was asked, I've been asked this question millions of times. People come to me, my grandparents come up to me, they ask, do you want to be a soloist? Isn't that what you should be doing? But at the same time, even playing solo music is a form of, I think, chamber music. You play with a pianist, or even to your audience, you're communicating something. So when I'm playing chamber music, which I do a lot at Juilliard, or playing in orchestra, I get the same satisfaction and in playing basically any music, so I'm open for a lot of options. The reason really that I play music is we still all listen to music that's been around for hundreds of years, and we still think it's the greatest, so why not play it?
And what of the future? I mean, tonight is going to be very exciting, but presumably you're already beginning to hatch plans for new collaborative projects.
Well, after Kommilitonin, which was, as Ara says, was our wonderful co-commission of Sir Peter Maxwell Davis and David Pountney, who both directed and wrote the libretto for that, we thought this is going to be a hard one to trump. And of course, it was very nice to have this prom lined up. But again, we return to the idea of what is it that we can do that we wouldn't necessarily be able to do on our own, and how can we bring a particular challenge to these incredibly hardworking, talented young musicians, both sides of the Atlantic. And we are cooking up a couple of things for the next 4 or 5 years. one or two or three, I can't remember, are, but...
We have a big appetite.
Well, we're all very much looking forward to it as well. Thank you very much, Jonathan Freeman-Atwood, Fabiola Kim and Ara Guzaliaman. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall now for the second half of tonight's prom, featuring the orchestras of the Royal Academy of Music and the Juilliard, conducted by John Adams. We're going to hear John conduct one of his own works, City Noir, premiered in 2009 in the city which it describes, Los Angeles. He wanted to write a symphonic soundtrack to the LA of film noir, the movies depicting the rather sleazy life of the city in the 1940s, a time of sensational journalism and even more sensational crimes. Tell us what inspired you to write this piece. Take us back a little bit through the history of it.
I was asked to write a piece for the Los Angeles Philharmonic to celebrate Gustavo Dudamel's appointment as music director, and this was his first official concert. And I wanted to create a piece that had something to do with California. So I thought that I would create this piece so it has some of the signal musical gestures that you know in this music, this kind of suppressed violence, the nervous jazz drumming in the background, the scurrying woodwinds, the saxophone kind of bouncing and creating these jagged lines, and then big brass climaxes, and then big, lush string melodies that go way high up into the stratosphere and way down to the lowest notes. I've been asked whether City Noir is site-specific. You know, are any locations or street corners cited in it? No, I think it's really just the mood and the affect. You're welcome to imagine your own movie. There's one spot, which I remember Gustavo loved when I told him, that the first two movements are conjoined, so it's all one large musical structure. The last movement's called Boulevard Night, and it begins with these very slow evolving chords, and above it this kind of tintinnabulation in the harps and celesta and piano. And I said, well, just imagine you're looking at a city from a distance at night, and you see the lights twinkling in the distance, and Gustavo liked that. He turned on to that. But I think the fun of or the meaning of listening to symphonic music, as we do with Mahler, is not to be told what it is.
There is another lovely line in which John Adams says that this music should have the slightly disorientating effect of a very crowded boulevard peopled with strange characters, like those of a David Lynch film, the kind who only come out very late on a very hot night. Well, John Adams will soon be taken to the stage to conduct this piece, and this time the orchestras of the Royal Academy of Music and the Juilliard are going to be led by Fabiola Kim from the Juilliard, who you heard in that Proms Plus interval talk. And the orchestra tuned up now, poised, waiting for the appearance of Fabiola, and here she comes. Her turn to lead this extraordinary group of young, talented musicians. A true child of the Juilliard, apparently. Her parents met when they were students there. And now here comes John Adams, composer of City Noir, which he is about to conduct. A man held in great affection by this combined orchestra of the Royal Academy of Music and the Juilliard. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Adams' City Noir, conducted by the composer, who's punching the air right now as he accepts the cheers and applause of this Proms audience. He's brought the merged orchestras of the Juilliard and the Royal Academy to their feet. They played out of their socks, didn't they? Great homage to the LA of film noir. You could just picture those David Lynch characters. Special mention perhaps should go to alto sax player Patrick Posey. He studies at the Juilliard. Amazing solos there. For those of you who possibly have been tweeting during that performance, a lot of you got in touch about his playing. John Adams coming back to the stage now, not just popular with the players, but hugely popular with this audience. He's someone who holds a very special position in American music. He's been composing since he was 10. That's the sax player being brought to his feet. That's Patrick Posey. John Adams now blowing kisses to the percussion section and to the rest of the brass section too. And the horn player being brought to his feet too. As I say, John Adams, he's always mentioned alongside Philip Glass and Steve Reich as one of the great American minimalists. He's been playing the clarinet since he was a kid, used to play in marching bands. Perhaps they're best known now for some of his operas. Later on this season, he'll be back at the Proms with Nixon in China. Great cast, including one of his favorites, baritones, Gerald Finley. He's such a nice man. He's now hugging all the members of the front desk. Bringing, what must be, what, 100 young musicians to their feet? But yes, his operas, which are Nixon in China, Dr. Atomic, The Death of Klinghoffer, they're some of the best known and perhaps most influential operas by a living composer. Taking political, historical themes and really bringing them to life. In 1971, he drove a beaten-up old VW Beetle to California, and he's been living there ever since. Feels so strongly about working with these young people. He was extremely inspirational when I was talking to him earlier. Absolutely loves the energy that he gets from them, and you can tell the feeling is completely mutual. Well, it is... has really been an exciting prom tonight. I do hope you've enjoyed it at home as much as we have here in the Royal Albert Hall. As I say, you can hear John Adams conducting his work Nixon in China on the 5th of September, and you'll also be able to hear one of his most popular short orchestral pieces, that Short Ride in a Fast Machine, at the Wallace and Gromit prom in August, which should be a riot. But now as the cheers continue and the general love-in on stage continues as well between the orchestras of the Juilliard and the Royal Academy and their conductor, the composer John Adams tonight, it's time for me to hand you back to John Shea in Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Katie. That was Katie Derham at the Albert Hall tonight, and we'll be back there tomorrow evening in the company of Louise Fryer for a concert by the BBC Philharmonic, music by Richard Strauss, Kaya Sarriaho, and Sibelius. In the first half, Anna Schwanewilms sings the four last songs, and the concert begins with Strauss's Also sprach Zarathustra. After the interval, the first UK performance of Laterna Magica by Kaya Sarriaho, and the concert ends with Sibelius's Seventh Symphony. Juan Colmena conducts the BBC Philharmonic, and that's tomorrow night at the Proms from 7:30. As you may well know, all concerts in the BBC Proms are available on demand for 7 days after the live broadcast, so you can listen to them again via the Radio 3 website. And what's more, most of them get another airing in the afternoon a few days later. So you can hear tonight's concert again on Radio 3 on Wednesday from 2 o'clock. And meanwhile, tomorrow afternoon at the same time, you can relive Saturday night's performance of My Fair Lady. Well, next weekend, the music of Berlioz comes to the Proms.
The 2012 BBC Proms. Les Troyens at the BBC Proms. An astonishing score, a summation of a life's work in music, and a work the composer himself never heard complete. The cast of the Royal Opera's new production reunites under the music director, Sir Antonio Pappano, in a concert performance of Berlioz's epic opera. Berlioz's Troy story, Les Troyens, the Trojans, at the BBC Proms. Sunday afternoon and evening from 4:30 on BBC Radio 3.
That'll be presented by Donald MacLeod. Well, next tonight on Radio 3, the first of this summer's Lebrecht interviews. This evening, Norman is in conversation with the conductor Gustavo Dudamel, and that follows in 5 minutes or so. So before that, following on from Ravel's bluesy piano concerto in the first half of tonight's prom, another musical meeting between America and France. Aaron Copland studied in Paris with Nadia Boulanger in the 1920s, and these are four piano blues that he wrote at various times between then and the 1940s. Bringing a Gallic flavour to Copland's music, the pianist on this disc is Michel Legrand.
Thank you.
for Piano Blues by Aaron Copland, played there by Michel Legrand. This is BBC Radio 3 at 12 minutes to 10. Now, on Monday evenings throughout the prom season, we're going to be featuring the Lebrecht interview, in which the writer and broadcaster Norman Lebrecht speaks to leading figures in the music world. Here is Norman to introduce the first of his guests.
Gustavo Dudamel is the most meteoric musician of modern times. Winner at 23 of a Gustav Mahler Conducting Prize in 2004, he now conducts the world's top orchestras and is the youngest ever music director in America. During his breathtaking ascent, there has been no want of jealous mutterings and imputations of hype. Yet few who've seen him at work come away unimpressed by his musical impact and his educational zeal. This summer he opened the Olympic Cultural Festival in a deprived council estate in Raploch, Stirling, coaching children to play Beethoven. The son of two musicians in the Venezuelan town of Barquisimeto, Gustavo Dudamel became a protege of the economist José Antonio Abreu, founder of El Sistema, which transforms street kids into orchestral musicians. He took up the baton at 14 and 4 years later was named music director of the Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra. After a 2005 BBC prom, he signed on with the Gothenburg Symphony in Sweden. 3 years ago, he arrived as music director at the Los Angeles Philharmonic, galvanizing the city with his extreme youth, Latino culture, and revivalist agenda. He's married to Eloisa, a dancer, and he's a pretty sharp mover on the floor himself. They have a baby son, Martin. We meet at an embassy in London following a series of concerts. Gustavo Dudamel, what have I forgotten in that summary?
No, nothing.
The colour of your eyes,
exactly,
possibly.
Maybe.
Knowing you a little, watching you at work, I get the impression that you live in the belief that music can change everything, yeah, can save the world. Is that an exaggeration?
No. I think the music have a very special kind of power in people. And you see the transformation can be a symphony by Beethoven, by Mahler, by Haydn. At the end of the performance, you can be changed, mm-hmm, by the music, feeling different things. I think music has a special
power.
How
does that work, Gustavo? I mean, you work with children who are literally God-forsaken. Nobody cares for them. Yeah. And you come in and you start playing Beethoven. How does that work?
An orchestra is a community. And in an orchestra, you have to play together. To play together, you need to have a discipline. To have the discipline, also you have to love what you do. The reason is the love to the music. That is what happened in El Sistema. For the transformation of the orchestra, we have all of that element. Discipline, the love of what we do, the access to beauty. That is such an important thing in our chaotic times. And then that transformation that the musician have in the process of learning a piece, of building an orchestra, building an interpretation, transformate directly also the audience. So it's an amazing interaction of what music can be, how powerful music can be.
I'm still not clear how. I mean, when one looks at people who are on the margins of society, mm-hmm, you get the sense that they don't value themselves. Is it somehow that the music restores value in their own eyes, that they start liking and appreciating themselves as they play, that they feel, I can do something, I can be part of something? How does the mechanism
but
work?
You know, they get the position in the society, and it's not, you know, we think to have sometimes position in a society, you need to have money or to be famous. You can be famous in 1 second. But the thing with the music, especially in the effect of disadvantaged people, mm-hmm, you know, is...
Is that the term that you would use in Venezuela, disadvantaged?
I think it's the right thing. Mm-hmm. It's the right term. Poor people, we can say, people that doesn't have the access to life. Mm-hmm. One thing is to be poor in the material things, but to be rich in your soul, to be rich in your mind, when you change that, when you change that conception of poorness, that is not about the material elements that you need to have, your vision about life changed completely. And then you start to be successful with your life. I always talk about beauty because our children doesn't have access to beauty in general. You know, and beauty, for me, beauty is art. Beauty is the access to have creativity. Through music, that is what is happening in Venezuela, you really get a transformation in the life of the children. And they can live in the same place where they were born, let's say, very humble place. But they change completely the life of their family and their community. That is amazing, because it's not an individual change. It's the change of the complete community, because the community feel proud of them. They support them. What an amazing thing that in a place where music was not part of their life, music became a symbol of life. And that happened in Venezuela. Naturally, it's difficult to explain because sometimes words don't help. You have to go in to see that transformation because it's really so powerful. Mm-hmm. It's really something revolutionary.
I was struck by something in the body language mm-hmm. in Los Angeles in the winter when for the first time the Simon Bolivar Youth Orchestra wore concert dress and they had been fitted for their suits and their dresses and they were walking through the streets of downtown Los Angeles dressed in these really sharp clothes and there was a swagger to them, but at the same time looking at their expressions and at the way that they were relating to each other, they were saying, this isn't me. I mean, this is the external, but the internal me is something else.
Yeah.
And they were more proud of that than they were of the new suits.
Yes, yes. Well, because it's still a youth orchestra, the Simon Bolivar Orchestra. Still people, with 16 years or 20. Some of us, we have 30. But for us, it's always a challenge. It's a challenge because in the musical world, we have a preconception of what we want to listen. And for us, it's completely different approach because for us, it's something new all the time. To play a Bruckner symphony is like the first time for us. It's like to play the premiere of the piece. And of course, we have versions that we listen. That we have the access, you know, to listen and to see. But the approach to the interpretation, sometimes people say, well, but this is a Latin sound. This is a different sound. It's completely different because it's an orchestra that have been learning how to play the instrument first together, then to play easy pieces, then to go to a symphony. It's not normal, because when you play, let's say, in a professional orchestra, you adapt to the tradition of the orchestra. In the Simon Bolivar, it's different, because all of them, they are coming from the same school, and we have been together for more than 14 years. Since we were 11, that we are together, we are talking about 20 years. At 11, we were playing easy pieces. That kind of approach to the music is a symbol of life for us. How music have changed our life in the most beautiful way. It's crazy. This gives a different kind of approach. It's never a routine in the way to play with the orchestra. Never. You can be playing the same piece to get, you know, maturity in the way to play, to understand. Sometimes we rehearse and we don't play pieces, for example. But we enjoy the process of the rehearsal because we learn. And the most amazing thing is the responsibility that the orchestra have with the society. What they feel, how responsible, how important is community. Look that we went to Rapla to play this open-air concert. It's not an important venue for symphonic music. We went to the community and they were sharing with children. The level is completely different. Bolivar is playing Beethoven III, Alpine Symphony. They are starting. But the compromise that they have for us was an inspiration. We went back 25 years. Woof! Immediately it was like we were sitting, we were dreaming, we were learning in that level. So it was so beautiful to see the children playing together with the Simon Bolivar Orchestra. having the support, the complete support of the community. This was raining, was cold, but the 8,000 people, they were there listening, enjoying music in the best level, because we were with a very difficult program. Beethoven III, an open air venue.
I can still hear the cold, well, the cold winds of Raploch in your voice. Feel.
Well, that is the thing. That is the beautiful responsibility. Sometimes we expect for the people to come to us. Sometimes we have to go to people. So what a beautiful thing is that now, for the Raploch community, music is a symbol of hope.
You make it sound like marrying the first girl you ever kissed. That everything is a voyage of discovery. The naivety is preserved because you're discovering the whole world together through life.
It's like that, yes. As a citizen of the world, as somebody like all of us, responsible for the future of the world, we have to fight, we have to work for the future generations to have a better ideas about how the world can work. I can do what I know, that is music. Other people will do with medicine, with everything. I think we have to go back, let's say, to Greece, antique Greece. Art was something primordial in the first level of life of people. The sensibility, the ideas. Idea in the big conception of ideas. You don't have to be an intellectual to understand beauty or to enjoy a good symphony. Music, art, open to you new doors. It's a little bit crazy to think in that way, but I think it's the most powerful way to change things. Crazy, but maybe possible.
The man you call Maestro, José Antonio Abreu, started El Sistema with the idea of taking children off the streets after school and put them to play in orchestras. Mm-hmm. The original slogan was play and fight.
Yes, still is.
What does that mean?
To fight, to build their life, to build their life through music. I think Maestro Abreu is an angel, somebody that is giving his life, his complete life, for an idea, for a collective idea.
It's such an unusual combination. A musician who became an economist, mm-hmm. member of parliament, mm-hmm. All of these things together, and at the same time physically quite frail,
yeah.
not a healthy man,
but probably
saved 300,000 children.
Well, but look, he's blessed. He has a special, you know, energy, you know.
Tell me about the first time you met him.
Wow.
You were how old?
I was like 8 years old. And I saw this guy with big glasses. He was young at that time. Maybe, let's say, 50-something. And was amazing, so generous. He came and he said, he offered instruments for us because we didn't have good instruments. Then the instruments arrived. We were like, wow, it's true, it's happening, it's great. And we have a great relation. We have a very personal.
From when you were 8?
I was always close to him because I was always asking things about music, about life. And then I became his pupil. In 1998, I think.
You say he was like a father.
He's like my father, yes. For all of us, naturally, when you are part of the family, you get a little piece of Abreu in your body. He can look fragile, but it's not. It's incredible how he works. He works the double of what I work. Or the triple. It's really amazing. And he really have faith. That is something that also we are missing in our times.
What kind of faith?
He really believe that music can be a key to change. We are talking about something really huge. Hundreds of thousands of children. You have to be a priest You have to really work. And Maestro Abreu is the head of all of that, but he's still dreaming and thinking. It will be beautiful one day to see one day in the life of Maestro Abreu, because you will get at the end of the day like, please, Maestro, let's go to rest. No, no, no. Now we have to go to the next rehearsal.
You were an only child. Mm-hmm. Were your parents not a little bit jealous that you were, that you became also a child of Abreu?
No. When I moved to Caracas, I was 16 years old. I was a teenager. And Maestro, she told my parents and my grandparents that I will take care of him. Don't worry. So he was like in charge, and they were agreed. He has been a father. You can be sitting 5 minutes with Maestro and then you learn thousands of things. Because always a conversation with him is like Plato sitting with, you know, his pupils talking about life. He's a philosopher of life, Maestro Abreu. Amazing.
Your grandmother used to get up at 3 a.m. to take you to Caracas.
Yes,
to see him.
Yes, it's true.
And she bought you your first baton.
Yes.
Was there never any time where you thought, do I need to go to rehearsal today? I want to go and kick a ball. I want to go and chase a girl. Were you never a little bit rebellious against this feeling?
No.
I want to have?
No. No, because the orchestra was for me, you know, also part of my free time, let's say. The time that I want to enjoy. I was always around my friends that they were in the orchestra. We were having fun in rehearsals, in the middle of a class, and then the rehearsal, we were playing soccer, or baseball, or something like that. So it was really natural. Still is the same. Still is the same. I think the orchestra became what is the orchestra, what is El Sistema, a family. When you see the interaction of the members of the orchestra, it's amazing because you see them as a family. Mm-hmm. It's nothing professional. Even they don't think as a professional thing. You know, when they say, you know, my colleague or something like that, they don't call them, between them, colleagues. They call, like, you know, my friends. The union. You feel that in the sound of the orchestra. When they play, when they, people ask me, when they move together, do you rehearse that? No, we don't rehearse that. It's part of the natural.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because if not, that will look no natural and will not sound natural. So the thing is that everything what happened is so natural.
The friends of yours from school who didn't join the orchestra, you grew up in quite a violent society.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the ones who didn't join?
Well, I have some friends that they're working, they're having good life. Others, they went in the other way. Sadly, some of them, you know, they got killed, you know, problems. I'm really proud where I grew up, you know. For me, it's part of my inspiration for every day, you know, for my life. I have a good memory and remember things really clear. For me, it was so important to be part of that community. 1.5 years ago, I went to La Urbanización Sucre, that is the name. And you know what was the beautiful thing of that? I went there, I went to visit the apartment where I was living. Then the community came, and almost all the children, they came with instruments. They came with instruments. And for me, it was like, wow. I feel really proud of them.
In a society like Venezuela, which has a revolutionary government, and where El Sistema is claimed by the Chavez government as one of its successors, mm-hmm. how does Sistema and you manage to stay out of politics?
Well, but you know, music is so far from politics. I love the power of the music. When you go to a concert in Venezuela, you see people sitting there having different ideas, political ideas, and they sit together. It's a moment of union. Mm-hmm. Music represents union. And that, again, is so powerful. We can see the power of music that can put people together. People maybe that in another place, they will argue, they will fight, then they are sitting, and it's a moment of union. We live in a moment of human crisis. We need things that can help society to breathe, to feel that it's still hope, because we are living a very pessimistic moment. The world is collapsing. Wars, people not having access to food, everything. We have to rethink life. The things that we think are not important, we have to put them in the important level. When it's a big crisis, the first thing that sometimes people caught is culture. Mm-hmm. And that is something crazy to think. If you think what arts can give to society is something more powerful than what we think. In El Sistema, I've become a symbol of our country. Not only of Venezuela, of the continent. El Sistema is a symbol, you know. The citizens of Venezuela, they feel proud of what Sistema has become a flag of the country. And for us, it's amazing and it's great because music in Venezuela became a right. It's in the constitution.
Every child has a right to learn an instrument.
The people have the right to learn music. It's an example. It's really an example of what we can do.
You conducted Mahler for the first time at 16.
16.
That must be a record. At 22, you go to Europe and you start to work with Claudio Abbado, Simon Rattle, Daniel Barenboim. I think every young conductor wants to know, how do you get to do that?
No, I think, my life has been so natural, Norman.
How did it happen?
I never have pushed myself. Yes, it was a challenge, especially to conduct Mahler when you are a teenager. Because, of course, you can move your arms, you can move your hands, you know, things will sound. But it's not easy to have a conception of a piece as difficult as is a Mahler symphony, as complex in feelings, in musical elements, in technical elements. That, for me, was a challenge for all of us, because it's still almost the same group.
We were
fighting and dreaming to play these symphonies. When we play now in Los Angeles, all the symphonies, we said, wow, you remember? And it was not such a long time ago. We are talking about 10 years ago when we were starting to work with the Fifth Symphony, to read the Seventh, some movements and everything. And now the orchestra is recording Mahler symphonies, playing the symphonies around the world. And you know, interpretations became more mature, but our goal is not to play the concert. Yes, we want to play the concert, but our main goal is to understand what we do.
You get a little sense of this when I see you in rehearsal with mm-hmm. them and in concert,
yeah.
That you're constantly challenging each other to go one step higher.
Yes, and that is important in what we do. For everybody have to be like that. In any profession, you know, things is an evolution. It's a process of an evolution, very powerful evolution.
So you come to Europe. Did Maestro Abreu make introductions for you to conductors in Europe? Did he introduce you to Claudio Abbado? Or?
Well, Abbado came to Venezuela in 1999, mm-hmm. I think, yes. And Maestro Abreu introduced me to Abbado. Sinopoli, I remember. We were in a tour with the orchestra. I met Rattle. I met Barenboim in Venezuela in 2001, I think. And yes, you know, Maestro Abreu
He opened a few doors.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you come to Bamberg, small town in Bavaria, and you win a competition that never existed before. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, overnight, the whole of the music business is buzzing. Gustavo Dudamel, who is? How did you know how to steer clear of the sharks and the snakes and everybody who was trying to get hold of you?
It was funny because I remember I arrived to their room and I had catalogs of companies to represent me, you know. And I had like 5 lunch in one day, you know, before. But I thought, now being honest to you, I didn't expect to win. I was hoping to go back home early because I was in Berlin with Rattle for a long period. And for me it was long, you know, to be out of Venezuela, of my home. I was thinking, how can I be sick to stay here? And then I won. And still for me, I don't know how I won the competition. And people, of course, flying around me to catch my attention.
You went to Gothenburg in Sweden.
Yes.
With Ed Smith, who was manager there, who had formerly been Simon Rattle's partner in Birmingham. And basically, that was to learn the repertoire with a very good orchestra, but somewhere out of the limelight. Yes, was that the idea?
Well, the Gothenburg Orchestra is a great orchestra.
Fantastic.
And it's our
orchestra. And very tough musicians, very stringent.
Tough musician, but also with a big reputation in the Nordic world of orchestras. With the background of Järvi, was like 22 years.
Nemi Järvi, that's right.
Nemi Järvi was conducted for 21, 22 years, the orchestra. And then Mario Benzago for a period. Then they called me, and we were doing a lot of repertoire, a lot of important repertoire. It's a risk to have a young conductor. You don't know what will happen, you know, experience, especially for an orchestra of a tradition with Sibelius, Nielsen, and all of this repertoire. But they say, well, let's do Sibelius.